Greetings to you, O beautiful children of the universe. It is I, your host, D. Trussell, a.k.a. Lord Barium. And I just want to say hello to all of you out there. I am ecstatic right now, my friends, for the nerdiest reason of all time. I found a new office, number one, which doesn't sound that exciting, but compared to the other office I was in, which was a wonderful place, it's got way better sound quality. It doesn't echo. The other place I was in was a mausoleum and a cemetery, so everything was echoing off the marble walls, and it would disrupt nests of birds and bees and would swarm around me and sting me. I was swollen and puffed every day coming home to my sweet family. But this place is in an actual music studio in Asheville, North Carolina. I don't know how I got this lucky, but I'm here and it's wonderful. And here's the nerdy, ecstatic part. I got my modular synths out of storage and hooked them up and they worked. It's a weird thing to be so attached to something that is just a machine, but I don't know if they're a machine. I love them, and it just, I can't even explain to you how great it feels to have made the weird transit from LA to Asheville and to find myself in a beautiful music studio and a beautiful office with my sweet modular synthesizers singing. I don't want to be attached to the world. I'd like to be some kind of Bhikkhu saint robed being happily wandering through the national forests with not a care in the world except for putting the bird's egg that I found on the ground back into the nest it came from. But it's just not my karma. I like stuff. I like gear and electronics, and I like watching lights burble and flash, and I like distorting my voice and just listening to electricity turned into sound. I can't help it. I just love it. It's like, it's a, if there was a clitoris somewhere inside of my psychic makeup, that this combination of stuff would be vibrating it until my entire soul squirted. I keep thinking, like, God, you know, I'm gonna regret leaving LA. Another shoe's gonna drop. I'm gonna feel some like aching horror. Like, what have I done? But nothing like that has happened yet. Only happiness and joy and just excitement. And I feel inspired. The air isn't filled with smoke. You know, it's, what the fuck? Why didn't I leave sooner? I guess it's just easy to think to yourself that you're above it all or something, or that, you know, where you're at is where you're supposed to be, and you just stay there. And I got all weird and spiritual, bypassed the entire reality of what my wonderful meditation teacher, David Nichtern, calls relative reality. You know, we live in a world. You've got a body. If you're me, you've got a muscular, beautiful, tan body, a body that many people, when they see it at the beach, they marvel when I tell them that I'm 46 years old, and they say, you have the body of a 22-year-old athlete. It's happened many a time. People will come up to me, and by the way, I don't mind that. You know, I understand the power of my body is probably akin to that of like a nuclear power plant in the future, and so when people see it, they're just blown away by it. I am too, you know. I get fixated. I don't want to think of myself as a narcissist, but there's nothing I love more than standing in front of the mirror pouring oil on my nips and my rippling pecs and abs, and just rubbing oil in. That's what I'm doing right now actually, is just rubbing oil into my body as I listen to my modular synths. We have got a great podcast for you today. A comedic genius was kind enough to appear on the DTFH for the first time. Tom Papa is here with us, and we get deep We're going to jump right into that. But first, this.
The reasons that your nipples bleed. The reasons that your breath smells like pee. The reasons that you don't feel right is because you don't have a motherfucking website. Squarespace, you can sell your socks online. Squarespace, you could put up a blog about vintage wine. Whatever you need, Squarespace is the place.
A heartfelt thank you to the folks at Squarespace. They're one of my longest running sponsors. I think the longest running sponsor for the entire DTFH. And I'm proud of that because they are a bad-ass service. Look, you want to build a website in seconds because you're in a hurry? Maybe you're in the midst of some kind of intense manic episode and you've just realized that you're the Messiah and you want to send your message out to the world in a modern way instead of writing some shitty manifesto and leaving it on park benches. Squarespace can get your manifesto up in seconds. They're amazing. They've got mix and match templates that you can use to make a simple website or something of such complex beauty and harmony that angels weep when they see it. You can look at a website like that by going to duncantrussell.com, which is a Squarespace website. They have got everything you need. You want to sell your stinky socks online? You can do that. You want to sell your fine vintage wine that you found in an old shipwreck somewhere? You can do that too. Not only that, but if you want to do mass mails to your fans, Squarespace will handle that for you. This is a futuristic, amazingly powerful service that can get your ideas and vision out to the world so that you can at last rise to power and let the world feel your spiked stiletto dig into its trembling back as you tap dance erotically on the flesh of all humans, teaching us the true meaning of pain. TrueMeaningOfPain.com, by the way, is available, and you can get that by going to Squarespace. Give them a try. Go to squarespace.com/Duncan, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan, and you will get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Again, that's squarespace.com/Duncan. Use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. Dear Duncan, ever since I joined your Patreon, the dreams in which I was being assaulted by masked bandits on a post-apocalyptic highway, bandits that would take me and my family and crucify us, hanging us on telephone poles while sicking their trained predatory falcons on my wife and child. In these terrible dreams, I would watch my family slowly be consumed by falcons while I died a very painful death by suffocation and grief. But ever since I joined your Patreon, those dreams have stopped. I feel as though a curse were lifted from my life thanks to joining your Patreon. And now every dream I have involves a Class A high-powered Dr. Ruth level orgasm. Thank you so much for creating the Patreon community that I can now enjoy. And most importantly, thank you for lifting the horrible dreams that you had cursed me with for not joining your Patreon and replacing them with sex dreams. Sincerely, Derek V. Derek, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to have relieved you of your horror dreams and replaced them with sex dreams. And for those of you who have yet to join the Patreon, who still find yourself in a variety of horrible nightmare scenarios every night, some people are being eaten by hyper-intelligent reptilian alligator creatures wearing robes and holding dark hypnotic lanterns over their heads while they drip acidic drool into their eyeballs, and other people are feeling what it's like to be trapped in a slit in the side of a massive cliff that perfectly aligns to their body and where they live forever, eternally imprisoned in stone. And of course, some people are experiencing a classic firing squad scenario where they are blindfolded and marched in front of mercenaries and have to listen to their comrades being shot until they at last take a bullet. I don't want to put dreams out there like that that make people not sleep well at night. But that being said, I've got a family now. And we got to do what we got to do. So if you join the Patreon, not only will these horrible dreams go away, but you will have instant access to hours and hours and hours of extra DTFH content. If you subscribe to the video tiers, my dear loves, you can join us every Tuesday for our group meditation, Journey into Boredom, or on Wednesday for our legendary book club, which The New Yorker called an assembly of some of the most literary geniuses that have ever roamed the surface of this planet we call Earth. And then on Fridays, it's our family gathering where we all just hang out and yap. And of course, you'll be able to join the growing, thriving DTFH Discord community. We want you. Come home to your family. Stop the terrible dreams. Go to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. Unless you're a time traveler from far in the past, or you just stumbled out of your Nietzschean cave up in the mountains where you had some grand revelation that you're going to bother all of us with while we try to enjoy our fucking coffee. We get it. You're an enlightened nihilist. Leave us alone. We like it down here. We like being worldlings. Regardless, unless you're some kind of monastic freak who's been holed up in some magic palace with all your monastic friends chanting. Unless you've been up in the Himalayas holding space for us so that we could experience peace and not be sucked into some vortex of destruction. Unless you're some dimension-hopping bard who plays flutes for hominid hummingbird creatures in some paradise realm. Unless you're a classic old mean warlock who has been hanging out in the cremation ghats of Varanasi, stealing skulls and gnawing on half-baked femurs. Unless you're some kind of little baby who doesn't understand English yet, just a little tiny baby who can't understand words because you're just a pure being of love. Unless you're the wind from the past, unless you're a drifting echo in some canyon somewhere, you know who Tom Papa is. He is a brilliant comedian. He's also a great writer. I'm listening. I like to listen to books, okay? I'll admit it. I can't read. I never learned how. But he's got a great book out called You're Doing Great. Also, I was on his podcast, Breaking Bread. Not only that, he's got a show on Netflix, Is a Joke Radio, with Fortune Feimster called What a Joke. Check out his Netflix special, live in New York City, or You're Doing Great, or you can go see him. Go see him. November 6th in Omaha, November 12th in Cleveland. Omaha is The Waiting Room, Cleveland is Hilarities. All the links you need to find Mr. Papa are going to be at duncantrussell.com. Now, everybody, please welcome to the DTFH, Tom Papa. Tom, welcome to the DTFH. Thank you so much. I know you just got off the road. Thanks for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. You know, I love you, and I love being anywhere in your orbit. And I know, what a cool thing to hear. You just got off the road. Oh, when's the last time you heard that?
I just want to start off talking about that. Can you tell me what doing stand-up comedy in the era of COVID is like? Because I haven't heard any reports from anybody so far.
Yeah. It's amazing. First of all, the short answer is it's amazing. I've only been going out since we all got shut in. I've gone to 4 different clubs. I went to Salt Lake City, Portland, Connecticut, and this last one was in Denver. And I only go to places where I know the people that run the clubs, know that they're going to do it right. Social distance, half the capacity, testing everybody. And if the city is cool, you know, there was like, I was going to go to Arizona and it was not cool. The numbers were rising. And
right.
I just got a vibe from the place that hired me that they weren't on top of it.
Right.
So they weren't going to protect me or the audience. So I just bailed. But if I can just get a little semblance of like, this is going to be okay. I just, you know, I can't not do it. I just have, it's just too much a part of me. And I just realized let's do a calculated risk and go and do the shows. And man, you really realize how important it is, you know, for the audience and for yourself to be working through it. I mean, that's what comedy is, right? It's like working through whatever you're going through, and that we're all going through the same thing. Despite being different places around the country, we're all gone through the same stresses and worries and anxieties and euphoria. And there's this common thing, and a comedy show where you actually get to talk it out and laugh about it and feel okay about it and enjoy yourself. Oh my God. It's just been, it's better than any of the shows you were doing like up to the end.
Oh God, you're making me ache. Hearing about it, man, it's just ache. Oh my God, I miss it so much. It becomes a part of you. It becomes a way that you exist in the world, and then it all got taken away from us. You're brave to do it, and also it's really very generous of you in the sense that you know whatever you are making is going to be cut in half. You know.
Oh yeah, it's definitely not about the money for sure. But you go into these places and they're trying to stay open. They're trying to survive.
Yeah.
And the wait staff is trying to survive. And, I went into Portland and, you know, the wait staff was like, they were a week and a half away from losing their apartments because they had no work. And just that everybody's able to come back in some form.
Yes.
It just felt like, you know, and you care about these places. I've been to these places for a long time. In Denver is the Comedy Works. And I know Wendy who owns
one of my favorite clubs of all time. It's an amazing place.
Amazing. And you want them to survive. You want them to, you know, and there's not a lot of people that can sell tickets that are willing to go. So I just figured, well, let's just try and be safe about it and smart about it and go and give them a good weekend and see if it's good for them, it's good for me, and see how we survive.
You know, I was listening to your excellent audiobook. You're doing great. And thinking, this is a very spiritual book. Like, this is a deep spiritual book, and it's also very funny. And I was so impressed that you figured out a way to do that, because you know, whenever I'm thinking about stuff, especially writing a book, I always get too up in my head about it. And I always think I want to write a book that makes people feel great, but I don't want to write a spiritual book or a correctional book or a self-help book or anything like that. And so it always just dies on the vine. But can you talk a little bit about the process of writing that book and how you managed to broadcast something so sweet and positive and real without sounding like stuffy?
Yeah. Well, it kind of came off of what I was talking about on stage at the same time. And I just had this feeling that, I was just doing my stand-up and just being as funny as I could about, you know, my stand-up is mostly about like life and everyday life kind of stuff. And, And I just got this feeling that we, over the last several years, like there was this real anxiety that people were feeling. And I felt like we were, I was feeling it too, like through social media and spending all our time concentrating on things that were just making us feel kind of shitty. And I just took a step back and was like, you know, this is it. Like, this is the prime time for us. Like, you know, we're going to get old and shitty someday at a certain point. You're young and living someone else's life for a long time. This is it. This is all you get, this little chunk in the middle. Why would I spend all this time, reading about politics or being fed stuff by cable news? Or, like, what am I wasting my time on? And you know what? And as I started looking at it, I was like, you know what? I shouldn't be racing so hard. What am I racing for? Like, this is it. You're actually doing great right now, right here. This is what great is. It's not about what's coming. It's not about trying to get more. It's not about trying to get on a jet or all this other stuff. It's like, no, this is it. This is us doing great. And I just started recalibrating in my head what the purpose of all of this is. And I realized, no, a cup of coffee is great. Just hanging is great. Being with your friends is great. And I just started saying to the audience in my stand-up, you're doing great. Just, I was trying to impart this kind of thing. I'm like, no, you're doing great. In the not too far distant future, people are going to ask you to go somewhere. And your one question is going to be, are there stairs? And if there are, you're not going. So you are doing great right now. I don't care what your problem is. This is it.
Yeah.
And people started coming up to me after the shows and thanking me. And that's when I kind of knew, like, I was on to something. Because I wasn't just feeling it. They were feeling it. And they were thanking me for saying that they were doing great. Because they think they're trying to do all the best. They're trying to work hard. They're taking care of their family. They're doing whatever. But no one ever tells you that, as an adult, like, hey, good job. Hey, you're there. You're doing great. So when people started coming up and thanking me, and I just started diving deeper into that. I used that as kind of the launching point for everything that I was doing, the act, and then for the book. And in the book, you can go deeper, you know? But I was that thing, like you're saying, like, I didn't want to just, I wasn't going to turn into some self-help guy. I just found a funny realization that this is what life is all about. So all my comedy should just come from that. And I just wanted to be kick-ass funny. And what was weird, Duncan, is that when I started giving interviews about it, people wanted to talk about that part of it. And it was like this weird balance between being really funny and also having a message that was pretty poignant.
This episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by AMC Shudder. You're gonna die. You're gonna die. I'm listening to you. I'm watching you. You're gonna die. Hey, look, you gotta freak yourself out sometimes, man. And I don't wanna be spoon-fed this boring, spineless, pseudo-comedy horror shit that you find on some of the other damn streaming services. I want terror free-based right into my main horror vein. I want to get splattered with guts and gore and feel sick and sad and confused about why in the name of God would I be subjecting myself to such absolute terror and fear. I want to be paralyzed in terror sometimes. I mean, give me a break. It's fall. Halloween is coming. And Shudder has got just what you need if you want to put a spike of sweet fear right in your trembling, splattered brain. They're spooky 24/7, 365, but like they like to be a little extra for Halloween, and this year they're going all out by turning the normal 31 days of Halloween into the 61 days of Halloween! They have controlled time and space! They are transforming everything into a world of blood and darkness! Try Shudder out. They are amazing. I am a horror movie nerd, and I love that the folks over at Shudder have created an assemblage of such fantastic horror that it makes me feel like when I was staying with my dad in the summers after the divorce, and he let me get videos at the video store down the street. As long as they weren't porn, I could get anything I wanted, and I would get horror movies and watch them all day long. They don't just have your classic, awesome horror. They also have new original series such as Creepshow. My dear friend Rob Schraub, not to name drop, directed a beautiful episode. Creepshow is true to form. If you like the Creepshow movies, you're going to love the Creepshow series. They got The Color Out of Space with Nicolas Cage. They got Scare Me with Josh Rubin. Trust me, if you're like me and you like actual horror, and you've been frustrated over and over again by not being able to find some of the classics, you are going to love Shudder. Get started streaming the best horror, thriller, and supernatural content. Shudder's expertly curated collection, including titles like the acclaimed Tigers Are Not Afraid, One Cut of the Dead, the Creepshow series. If you want any of this brilliance, you can go to Shudder. You can try Shudder free for 30 days. Go to Shudder.com. Use promo code Duncan. That's S-H-U-D-D-E-R. Give them a shot, man. You know what? If enough of you sign up, then maybe they would actually let me make a horror movie for them, which would be a delight. If you're listening, Shudder, come on. Let me on board. I got some ideas. If you can bring the two together, it is a nuclear bomb. It's so good because when they're not together, God, it's so easy to not be funny. It's so easy to be didactic, correctional. You know, it's so easy to go on and on about some kind of arcane spiritual shit. But yeah. To like make it funny, to bring it into the world in a way people can connect to, wow, yeah. That is a talent, man. And what a lot of what I've listened to so far in the book, and by the way, great job doing an audiobook, it reminds me of Ram Dass. It reminds me of Be Here Now. That's what I loved about him was he wasn't trying to fix you. There wasn't a thing of like, hey, yeah, we got to get you meditating, get you on a vegan diet, get you to drink more water, get you to this retreat, get you in a fasting situation.
Yeah.
It was, this is exactly where you're supposed to be. It's the perfect place. You're exactly where you need to be right now as you are. You can give up the war against yourself.
Right, right.
And I love those moments when I can pull that off. I don't pull it off all the time, but that's what I do you think we're in heaven?
That was a curveball question at the end. No, I don't think we are. I don't think we are because there's so much... I don't know. There's so much pain, but I don't know. That's a hard question. What is heaven? The sneaky thing about it is I'm really into TM. I've been doing TM for a long time.
Cool.
And that kind of is like this slow way. It's kind of like aspirin. You're not really sure how it works, but it just seems to work.
Yeah.
And it just kind of opens up your consciousness in a way, slowly. I was just doing it to have more energy to get through the day. But there seems to be this a little more keen awareness that this is where you're supposed to be. So I don't know. Is there a little glimpse of heaven in that? I don't know. You know, but there is this kind of more accepting feeling that all this noise up here, while it's dominant and you have to participate in it, just knowing that you're also existing down here,
in this
other more peaceful place, is it does give you this kind of happy feeling that this is okay. That knowing that below this noise, there's something more important going on, has been kind of like the end result of the TM thing. So I think it's kind of bled. Without even thinking about it, it wasn't a hippy dippy trying to, figure out all the stuff about TM, but I can tell that it has informed my view,
Yeah. It did something. It does do something. A lot of my friends do it, and it is, I've never heard anyone say it didn't work for me. I've never heard someone be like, TM sucked. It was bullshit. I've heard people who haven't done it complain about having to pay for it. They're like, it should be given away. I don't understand why people think like that, but anyone right. I know who's done it really appreciates it. But what I meant by the heaven question is, like, just sometimes when I'm thinking about when I'm able to, like, get into the groove of just me instead of how I wish I were. So anything that's happening, I'm like, yeah, this is how you're supposed to feel. Like,
yeah.
And even if the feeling is like, God, I'm fucking sweaty and hungover right now and just feel kind of dizzy. It's like, that's right. That's good. That is it. It's what's in your book. And then I start thinking, like, holy shit, is this paradise? And the genius of paradise is that you find out that you're in paradise. You know, I mean, if you're just born into paradise, that's not fucking paradise, you know, but it's this slow boil as you start realizing, wait a minute. Oh, wow. This is actually heaven, but not heaven like in the whatever your religion may be, streets of gold, all that bullshit, but heaven in a more fundamental, primal way, which is just sentience, existence itself has some kind of quality in it of goodness, even when it hurts.
Yeah, and back to what you were saying before, how, like, you can't do it all the time. I don't think we can do it all the time and exist in this world. Like, I feel like, and I think that's what TM does. I think that just whatever people do to give you, I feel like you can, if you can just dip into it just for a glimpse once a day, it's like the stop and smell the roses thing. It's like you don't need some big practice to just be grateful when you're eating the strawberry to really think, to stop and actually really appreciate all the aspects of the juiciness of the whatever, like just those little, just allowing yourself one moment of that in a day seems to me to be super valuable. And I think that's kind of, you know, in some other world, if I was in a robe and I could just live in a monastery, I could work on getting that blissful state all the time. But, you know, I've got kids, I've got a comedy, I've got a show tonight, I've got, you know what I mean? Yeah. You got stuff to do.
Well, so this is what I love, is I've been taught in Hinduism, whatever that word means, there's these different ashrams, like ways of living. And there's the brahmachari ashram, that's what you're talking about, the robes, the shaved head, that shit. We didn't get that. Then there's what's called the Grihastha ashram. That's what you're in. It's called the householder ashram. And that's considered as valid a path to liberation as shaving your head and wearing robes, actually. Yeah. There's no difference in the two. And they're both considered like a form of like living in a temple. It's just, isn't that cool? It doesn't exclude anything. It's all, you know, some really people's karma is you just get lucky and you're born here and you don't get all glued into the system like we are. And that's really good karma. And it's great if you could, but I would never ever want to be a monk. I would be, fucking hate that.
I know. I'd be a horrible monk.
I'd be the worst monk of all time.
Trying to make jokes during that tension. How could you resist?
And it sucks. You know, I've heard it really sucks. Like, I've heard, like, it's not, like, our idea of the monastic life is imaginary. Yeah. Like, my image in it is just a tranquility, peace. You sit in flowers, chant and shit. But the real version of it is you're, like, in this stinky place with like all these farting dudes from eating all the vegetarian and they get in fights. You're like, you used to have the same like dormitory tensions and stuff.
Oh,
and
God.
No health insurance. So that's a big problem with monks, is they get really sick because they don't have health insurance. And so,
oh my God.
Some, it depends on the monk or the monastery. But yeah, they're like, it's not fun to be a monk.
No way. I couldn't do it. I mean, and that seems to be like the thing. It's like you're always balancing and you're always doing stuff and you always forget because you got this stuff to do and you have other people to think about. But I just think it's kind of like your diet. Like, sometimes when I'm just, whenever I get, like, heavier or just kind of, like, go on, like, you know, a couple months of eating poorly, it's because I'm just not thoughtful about it. I'm just not thinking about it.
Right.
And as soon as you kind of just pay attention to it, it all kind of gets corrected. Like, there's such a real value to just paying attention and being more thoughtful towards anything.
Anything.
You know, your work, your diet, your family. Just not just doing it, but just giving yourself a minute to actually think about what you're doing.
Yeah.
That kind of makes all the difference.
Yeah, I learned from my dogs because they don't think about anything. And they just eat shit. They'll literally just like decide to eat shit. Like one of my friend's dogs was over at the house once and years ago when we had a cat and like we're, you know, the dog comes bounding onto the couch, sweet dog. And suddenly the stink of like cat litter and cat shit just starts rising up from this dog's mouth because it is gone indie. And they, you can buy at pet store stuff you feed your cat that makes their shit not taste good to dogs.
Oh, like, that's great. But I need that actually.
Do your dogs eat your cat's shit?
Yeah, I have a new. We have a new pug who is like it's like living with a goat. he just eats everything. It takes things out of the garbage and awful. The cat litter, everything.
That's that. And to me, like anytime I go unconscious, like what you're saying, there's no difference between me and that fucking dog. I mean, I'm not eating cat shit,
right?
But you know what I mean. I'm not thinking about what I'm putting in my body. I'm not thinking about how I'm sleeping or if I'm drinking enough water. You just go into this like I don't know, zombified state.
Yeah And then you wonder why, and then it's a cycle, because then you wonder why you're feeling headachy and lethargic and depressed. And it's like, well, if I just thought about what I was putting in my body to begin with, maybe everything would have kind of unfolded a different way. And it's like, you don't, you know, we always get these, I know I do, I get these like, I go on these jags where I start like, well, I got to really start something like it's a huge project.
Yeah.
It's too much. I'm busy. It's too much to fit giant projects in. Just, how about, just, oh, when you open the refrigerator, just think for a second. That's all. Just be more thoughtful.
See, no, this is what I secretly think, that there is a deep attachment to misery that humans have. And the reason what you're saying, ideas like that get rejected. In other words, like if I can imagine, like if I'm trying to think of like bullshit, crazy ideas I've had regarding getting in shape, you know, like I might suddenly start thinking like, you know what, I'm going to do Rogan's sober October thing, but I'm not just going to do that. I'm going to fast for 5 days
get some kettlebells.
Yeah, get, you know, just insanity that I'll never do. But yeah, just that little tiny shift is so easy, but somehow that simplicity is very difficult for people.
Why do we like misery, you think?
Well, it's you know, I think it's we like familiarity. So, you know, depending on your life, if you're born into certain circumstances, you just get used to disarray. You get used to madness. You get used to chaos. And you just, that's what you're used to. So if you start suddenly living in a clean environment, you can get homesick for that chaos, you know?
Right.
Is that do you think that's what it is? Or what do you think?
Yeah, no. I mean, that's kind of like when, if you ever date a girl who really likes to fight, it's like because she grew up in a fighting environment and they just like, they're comfortable there. And you end up fighting with her. If you're not a fighter, you're like a wreck and they're like happy. It's like that kind of thing. They just, you know, they're not aware that it's good or bad for them. They just, that's just what they learned.
Yeah. And that, you know, that once you realize that, you just stop feeding them. And then, well, sometimes that really helps. Like sometimes just not giving them the fight or just not like playing the role of the like person in the fight, that they just,
You should break up with them immediately and get out of there.
You think so?
Don't stick around.
Well,
you're a big enough project.
And trying to, but I think some people can't get out. That's the thing. Like sometimes people find themselves in a situation, you know, not with necessarily the relationship, but sometimes with parents, sometimes they're in a living situation that's just like, they're stuck. They're in the fucking monastery. You know, they can't get it. They're literally trapped. And so in that circumstance, I think it's worth experimenting with other, you know, with a project of like, well, at the very least, I don't have to play this weird fucking game. I mean, I don't know what your relationship with your parents is like, but when you start uncovering the script, You know what I mean? So, some people are living by a script. It's like they write, they're constantly writing this tragic play and they're giving you a part to play in it.
Yeah.
And if you're not careful, you just start playing the part.
I know. You fall into those roles that you're supposed to play. Like, that's why going home is always so difficult for people, like with the holidays and stuff, because they go out in their life and they're living as this free person who's doing all this stuff. And then you go home with your brothers and sisters and you're sitting, and all of a sudden you're back into that role that you've been playing between the ages of 5 and 18.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're not that person, you're not that new person anymore.
Do you do that?
No, a little bit. Not too much. I was everything was pretty cool. Like, I was the oldest, so I just dominated and was just the leader. So I continue to do that everywhere I go. but like little things, like more like with my parents probably, you know, like not so much with my siblings, but with my parents, like the way that you talk to your father or, you know, that kind of stuff, that probably is closer to playing the character in the script, you know, 'cause they, especially when they're older, you know, they're not rewriting the script.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, this is pretty much set. They don't have the, you know, your siblings are still like coming up with new roles. Your parents are kind of locked in.
You've heard of this, I'm sure. There's this like an idea that the observation of things at a quantum level seems to have an effect on them. Just observing them, just the very act of taking them in can change them for some reason. The field of awareness seems to produce some effect on things at the quantum level. And sometimes when I was around my dad in the earlier phases of my life with him, coming home when I'm failing at everything, I would look at myself in the mirror and be like, God, why do I look fatter in the mirror around my dad? Why do I feel, you know what I mean?
Honestly,
I think the reason you need to be very careful with your association, and if you can leave, is because it's not just that you're around someone who's starting fights with you, or it's that they have decided you're a certain way. And they believe it so firmly that it's literally sucking you in to that, their subjective universe. Like, they're in their very act of appraising you as in whatever stupid way they've appraised you, you start becoming it. You know?
Oh, man.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you start,
you
get in this weird quantum field. But if you're around someone who loves you, like my kid, and you get into that thing, it's like suddenly you're free. You feel lighter. You feel powerful. You feel like you could do anything.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of a, not to take too much of a pivot, but like when you think about it with your kids, you know, I have kids also. And I'm always kind of aware of that, of like, don't just because they were messy before doesn't mean they're messy this year. So you don't have to keep telling them pick up their shit because that's the way that it's been for the last couple of years. They're growing. They're changing. My views on them should be open and changing. But to go one step deeper with it, whenever I see like grandparents with their kids, it's nothing but pure love, right? It's nothing but, oh my God, the kid could do no wrong in the eyes of the grandparent.
Yeah.
It's just purely celebrating. Oh my God. Love, 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 love. And I'm always like, why not parent that way? Why not try and be that for the direct thing? But I always kind of run up, or parents always throw up in front of me, there's the disciplinary part of it that you need to teach them lessons. So you can't go all grandparent in when you're the parent.
No way.
Right?
No way. You can't. It's abuse. It's abuse. Like, these kids, you know, a kid does not need to worry about, you know, being the boss. You know, a kid doesn't need to worry about, you know, what the boundaries are. It stresses them out. It freaks them out. That's my kid. That's what I love. It's so fun to watch because, like, for example, he likes to stand up on the couch. But he's too little to stand up on the couch. He's definitely going to fall and hit his head on the hardwood floor. So you just can't do it. You can't stand on the couch in our house. Yeah. So what he does is he figures out exactly the amount of kind of standing he could do. You know, like he's he finds the exact limit. And then once he knows what that is, I don't know. Like you, that's the it's frustrating to have to be consistent with an adorable thing. You know what I mean? It's frustrating. Yeah. You want to be like, stand on the couch, party, dance, but they'll die. They'll kill themselves.
No. Yeah, there's a responsibility in it.
Yeah.
It actually maybe it would help me to think of it as you're actually showing them more love by being restrictive and teaching and, you know, saying no once in a while. Then if you were the goofy grandparent who just said yes all the time, that's actually less loving.
Yeah, it's less loving. It's like it gets you into all kinds of trouble. You know, I had Tim Leary's kid on my podcast once, and he told me this story of how Tim Leary and Ram Dass got him stoned when he was in high school. It was a special thing. They were like, we'll smoke this joint and like talk, and he felt like a grown up. You know, I think he was like a 10th grader, 11th grader, whatever. And so then, to, I guess, reward them for giving him any kind of liberty, when he left for school that day, he took the roach to school and smoked it in the playground with his friend. And the principal had to call Timothy Leary, you know, the great LSD guru, to come to get his kid. And Tim Leary's in there. He's like, hey, this might be legal one day, but it's not legal right now. you can't smoke weed here.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's, to me, it's like good parenting is like, not, even though you would like to get stoned with your kid.
Yeah.
Don't, because it's not,
right.
You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
exactly.
You can't, you gotta be a dad. That's the role temporarily. Yeah. That's what they want.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what you signed up for. You could do that with your nieces and nephews.
how old were you when you had your first kid?
I was like, I guess I was like 32.
Okay. So you were like doing comedy and parenting. Did you have were you worried that you would like maybe lose your ability to be funny or lose your edge, or that becoming a parent would in some way disrupt your ability to do stand up?
Not as far as what I was going to talk about. Like, not as far as, like, my stuff had always been, I've always really been interested in, like, human behavior and families and the dynamic of people and, like, all of that. I knew it was probably going to inform that, you know. I was a little worried that I just don't want to come out with, you know, a whole act of kids stuff, because it gets, I thought that would be, you know, it can devour your act.
Yes.
So I was worried about that a little bit. But then, you know, I kind of found that the one cool thing is, if you're not hacky and you're telling good jokes about all that stuff, every single person is in a family. So as long as you're just not doing retread stuff that's like, you know, lame parent to the kid or wife, you know, as long as you're creative and funny with it, it would be okay. But that took a little while to get comfortable with. But the one thing that I was worried about was just the energy, like the amount of energy that would be split mentally and physically with being in a house with kids, having a family, and then, as opposed to being just purely living in my apartment with nothing but comedy on my mind. Like that I was worried about. And I did the Tonight Show once with Leno, and it was the first time I had done it. And I did the set and then sat down on the couch with him, and off air they went to commercial, and the first question Jay asked me was, are you married? You married? I said, yeah, I'm married. Yeah, I'm married. And I said it like kind of like proud of it. Like, yeah, I'm married, and I've got a new daughter. And he was like, oh. And I just saw his eyes just kind of like avert, like almost like he was like, yeah, too bad.
Isn't that crazy?
I know, because he didn't do that. He got married, but no children. And I really took it as a, it felt like a judgment, like, well, it's, this is going to be harder for you.
It is. Well, I mean, I think in the world of comedy, in the same way there's like the brahmacharis and the grihasthas, the same thing replicates itself in comedy, which is like you get the loner, I don't know, Hunter S. Thompson style, like gonzo comic.
Yeah.
And they really don't look kindly upon the breeders. They consider it to be almost a failure, a sort of like,
right,
you know, you fucked up, you got, you know, you got married, you had kids. Come on. Every single breath you take, every moment of your life should be comedy until you die. That's it. And I've always found that to be the craziest fascist form of like thinking when it comes to art. It's, it's like, how the fuck are you? To me, having had a child and being married, I feel like now I really can connect with audiences.
Right.
You know, now I kind of do know more about the human experience and what some of these people are going through. Whereas before it was like, how do I even understand the world if my entire life is like snorting rails of ketamine and playing God of War and like making noises on my synthesizers?
You know? It's true. When we were thinking about it and we were like, are we going to do it? We weren't like, oh, we're definitely going to make a family. My wife and I were kind of analyzing it and thinking about it. And it's like, okay, so we're artists. She's a comedian too. And it was like, okay, so we're artists. Why would we pass up the single greatest experience or biggest experience that you can have as a human being? Like to bring life onto the planet. And like, as an artist, you'd be denying yourself this window into this whole other part. Yeah. And that really was like, okay, yeah, let's not be silly about this. Let's dive in. Now, is it more difficult? Like, does Bobby Lee have a lot more energy when he rolls up to the club after playing video games till 3 a.m. and then sleeping until 3 p.m.
probably.
And rolling in just for a sec? Sure, he probably has a little more of a twinkle in his eye.
Yeah.
I've been up at 6 a.m., banging out, driving kids to school, like just dealing with whatever. And, you know, yeah, it's a little more energy you have to, but then you have to get a little more serious in just how you treat it. And you have to do whatever you can, like we're saying, like eating or whatever it is that gives you the ability to do it. You got to be more responsible, I think, to your art. You can't just kind of like think it's going to happen like you did when you were 25 and alone.
Right. No, I love that, man. That's it. I think that's all it takes, really. Have you ever thought about your cellular health? No, me neither. Why would we? Because cells are the foundation of our health and make us who we are. And one of the important building blocks for our cells is called NAD, which is vital for things like sleeping, breathing, eating, drinking. You know, some of the most important stuff we do that we don't necessarily think about either. The bad news is, as we age, our bodies don't make NAD like they used to. And here's the good news. There's a way to boost your NAD levels thanks to True Niagen. True Niagen helps counteract the effects of time on your body by promoting cellular repair. It also helps with healthy aging by supporting cellular function and metabolism to maintain overall health and well-being. True Niagen can also help you increase cellular energy. It replenishes the decline in NAD due to stressors such as lack of sleep and overeating, so you can keep up with your active lifestyle. Taking True Niagen also helps with cellular defense in the face of stresses such as alcohol consumption or immune stress, which is a form of cellular stress. True Niagen has caught the attention of the scientific community with its remarkable ability to boost NAD. And they have over 10 clinical studies to prove it. Give your cells a boost with True Niagen. Right now, new customers can save $20 on a 3-month supply by going to TrueNiagen.com/Duncan. That's TRUNIAGEN.com/Duncan to save $20 on a 3-month supply. TrueNiagen.com/Duncan. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration, This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Thank you, True Niagen. I think the whole idea of like, here's how you do it is so nuts. Anytime anyone tells you like, this is the way, is so fucking crazy and so limiting. And so, I love being a dad. I love every bit of it, including the existential horror, including, you know what I mean? The moments of like, what have I done? The worry. And my heart's going to be broken forever. I will never have like a day now until I breathe my last breath where there isn't some piece of me thinking about my kid and missing him. And like, you know, but I love all of that, even though, God, Jesus, we did sacrifice so much autonomy. So much freedom, and more than anything, we really sacrificed the ability to be self-destructive, to be happily self-destructive.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it's just like, you know, people are built different ways, but, you know, when I see the guys that decided not to go down that path, I don't know. They don't seem complete. They don't seem content, you know? There's like, and I'm sure there's, you know people who famously like rail against it and like, oh, I never would. They all seem a little unhappy. seem like a little, there's something. And I knew we were just kind of on this path right before it where I was so obsessed with myself, like thinking about how I felt. I always thought like, am I getting sick or do I have this thing? It was just me. I was like, I remember consciously thinking right before she was born, like, it's going to be so nice to think about somebody else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Get out
of this. Because you're not that important, and it's not good to be that self-obsessed.
Oh, God. It puts you in this mode of thinking where it's like, right now, my thinking is like, all right, we want to buy a house. And the reason I want to buy a house is, look, the lifespan thing people do, where they're like, I'm going to live to the end of the human lifespan. It's like, well, you're crazy if you think that. You know what I mean? That's wild that you think you're going to get to live to be 70 or 80 or whatever. Why would you even think that? That's just an average. That's a tendency. But you know what I mean? You don't know that.
Yeah.
So I think now that I have a kid, my thinking is more along the lines of, all right, get them some land, get them a place where they can live, and then you can pass a house down to your kids. And that feels so much better than the other thing that you can slip into if you don't have other people you're taking care of, which is like weird shit. Like, I'm going to get a really nice, fast car. And you know, that kind of weird, where like you get all this weird shit around you that's expensive and you're, I don't know. But then on the other hand, I think we accidentally become tribalistic when we have a family, and suddenly the non-breeders seem like exactly what you're saying. You look at them and
you judge them. Yeah.
And they judge you. Like, we judge each other. Like, my non-breeder friends, some of them have gotten really harsh with me in passive aggressive ways, you know? And I know why. I used to think when I was a non-breeder, God, Jesus, man, I thought I was like Nietzsche or some bullshit. Like, I thought I'd really figured it out. Like, you know, I discovered the truth of like the failure of humanity and the idea that you're going to just make a thing. Or like, you listen to Jack Kerouac and he's like, do you ever listen to Jack Kerouac? Ever read Jack Kerouac?
I've read it, yeah.
I'm on a bit of a Jack Kerouac jag right now. One thing that's funny about him is the motherfucker loves to write poetry about people working, but he never is fucking working. He's always like the steel man. The other funny thing about him is he's like completely absorbed into the role of like the free poet. And one of the things he said is, beautiful women make graves. And you know what I mean? Because you get them pregnant and they have a kid. And to have a child is the sentence of being to death, is another famous thing he said. He's the ultimate example of the non-breeder. But do you ever have moments, though, where you're like, fuck, did I fuck up? Do you ever wonder, where do you think you'd be if you hadn't had a family? Where do you think you'd be if you didn't have a kid? What do you think you'd be like?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it's always, I mean, that's kind of what we're built for, is to second guess it. Your brain is always figuring out, is always going to work on something. So it's always like, yeah, what if we had done this or had done that? And I think ultimately there's no question that it was more rewarding and better. And, you know, especially now, you just have more perspective on what life is and what it's about. And it's like, you know, how many movies can you go see? How many times are we going to sit and discuss, you know, philosophy with this guy smoking a cigarette who thinks he knows what he's talking about?
Yeah.
It's just like, you're just spinning around and round and round, and everyone's done it before us. Kerouac did it before us, and Abbie Hoffman did it before us, and all these people have done it before us. And where did it get them? The same spot. They got them all to the same spot at the end. And, you know, you spent your time doing it, and it's like, okay, that's fine. If he really enjoyed it and wanted to go that way, good. God bless him. Good for him. But I know you probably feel the same way that I do, that it's pretty good knowing that we're absolutely right.
I love feeling that right. That's all I want to do is be right, completely righteous. I want to be the most right person on the planet. I don't think there's any one way to live or anything like that, but damn, I would never, I think back like, Jesus, I got so lucky that I'd have a kid. Like I get scared. You know that thing where people say, if you could travel back in time and tell yourself anything, what would you tell? It's like, I don't want to fuck up my timeline. Like, I don't, I would be afraid if I, do you ever think that? Like, it really freaks me out to imagine, like, what if I had jerked off the night before I had sex with my wife when we conceived Forrest?
Yeah.
I would have come his DNA, and he would never exist in the world. You ever think about that?
Right, he'd be a stain on a pillow.
Yeah, that thing. Do you ever just like it kind of makes me just like, it gives me this weird vertigo when you consider that like you almost didn't get to meet these beings,
right,
that are in your life because you came at the wrong time, or you came on her stomach or back.
I know. Yeah, no, it's yeah, that's a whole nother thing. I mean, to think of like every little decision in the past that would have been. I used to think about that in New York all the time. Like if I just left the apartment 1 minute earlier, it would have changed the whole thing of when I got down the subway steps into the train, saw those people, got popped out through the, just those like tiny incremental things that could change everything.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, I do feel like it's kind of, it's not that it's out of our hands, because I have not come down on whether this is all supposed to happen for a reason or whether I even have control over it. I haven't been able to figure out where I land on all of that. But I do kind of feel like this is kind of the part of the freeway of concerns up here.
Yeah.
And that, the whole thing of like who you're with and all of these bigger things just kind of, it's just part of the flow that's just deeper than all of these decisions up here. So like when Leno says, you know, do you have a family? It doesn't really matter. You know, it didn't matter what answer I gave him. That's not important. Like this stuff down here is important, and that'll manifest itself into all these other things, regardless of what decisions we kind of made.
Man,
that was a confusing answer.
It's a beautiful answer, actually. That's been my approximation of it, too, is I'm just not really I think the older you get, the more you start wondering just how much, who's actually, like, I think the way Ramdas put it was, who's minding the store here, really? Like who's
right,
doing this?
Right.
But I got a little Leno story. When I was dating Natasha Leggero, she was on Leno. And I was dead broke. I was driving this shitty car. I was going to see her on my very successful comedian girlfriend be on Leno. I almost didn't make it because my muffler fell off the car in the parking lot of the studio. And I had to like, I came in all greasy and shit. And he came into the green room and he said the most mortifying thing I've ever heard. It echoes in my head. And especially at that moment in my life, it really hurt. He said, and I can't do a Leno impression, but he said, if you're not on TV, you're losing. And it was the most,
oh.
like, it was like a, just a grabbed. It was like he just, for no reason, psychically knew the worst thing to say to me. It hurt so bad. But
that's
God,
brutal.
What an archaic, shitty, stupid way to think about existence. Like, who the fuck's on TV? Like, one minute, like, yeah, a tenth of the human population is on network television. Like, you feel like the whole planet is failing.
But is there something, and I go through this a lot with guys of our generation too, does it take that kind of drive, that kind of insane, ego-driven, single thought? You know what I mean? Like, you see it with, there's some people we know who are like crazy, crazy successful, and they just kind of carry this other level of ego.
Yeah.
That regardless of how talented they are, everyone has a little something, but the fame almost, it doesn't equate to the talent, but it does equate to the amount of ego, I am the greatest drive that they have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And I think at that time with him, like, he got to the top of that TV mountaintop because he did believe that, right? Like, that was all he was focused on. He wasn't thinking about having kids and doing all this other. It was purely, he couldn't allow himself to think otherwise.
Right.
I'm not saying it's healthy, but don't you think that there is something to those people? You know what I mean? Like,
well, what am I going to say? Jay Leno fucked up? It's like, you know what I mean? Like, what are you going to say?
Right.
He really screwed up his life as a comic. He made a lot of bad decisions to end up hosting the fucking Tonight Show.
Okay, I guess this is my question then. Do you need to have that in order to get there?
Well, I mean, the problem is that there, I don't even know if that there is there anymore. Like, that, I think in that time period, when I first came to the Comedy Store, that was it, man. And that, you know, people still have pagers. They get paged for their commercial auditions, stop at a payphone. They had Thomas guides to get to the, you know what I mean? There was no fucking internet. There was no way to do what we're doing now. Back then, technologically, if you wanted to do that, you would need a lot of money, and we didn't have any money to do that. So back then, he was right. Now, it's not the case. I think it's a whole different landscape now. And what's really confusing about it is you're not going to get any kind of affirmation from the old guard regarding this new way of being a comedian, because it's an existential threat. It's like, they're not going to tell you, you know, I got lucky, got this cartoon on Netflix, and I was
the greatest.
Thank you, friend. But you know, that was my first, you've been on a bunch of things. That was my first thing. And it was really exciting, but I was talking to some very successful podcasters, like very successful. And they jokingly, they were like, I feel weird that I don't have that. That I don't have the show thing. And it was so weird, because it's like, you do have a show. It just didn't happen. And their show, I'm sure more people have listened to them. Way more people have listened to them than saw my show. But because it's not a massive corporation knighting you by giving you a series, for some reason, it's still in us as comics to think, oh, I haven't reached the top. But it's like the new version of things is actually, you don't need a network anymore. Do you agree? What do you think about that?
No, 100%. I think there's so many more opportunities. And it's I always play around with, okay, so if I'm not selling out Madison Square Garden, is it because it's not really that important to me to sell Madison Square Garden? Like, we all kind of think, like, who's ever the biggest has to be, like, that's the ultimate. And I remember talking with Maria Bamford, and we were talking about the same thing. And she was, like, talking about, like a Kevin Hart. I don't think it was Kevin, but that kind of a guy who is just so good at being a corporation himself.
Yeah.
Like, he's building an empire.
Yeah.
Right? He's building this giant thing. He is selling out Madison Square Garden, and he also has production companies and TV shows, and he has a vitamin water and his own boner pills. Yeah. And I mean, whatever he wants to do, he's creating the thing.
He has
and
his it's own like, boner well, pills.
And he's seen as like the biggest thing of comedy. And I remember Maria just simply, who's so brilliant, she was like, who would want that?
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell some jokes and come home and make dinner with my pugs. And it was like, she was like, I just want to open a little bookshop. I don't want to be a corporation with people asking me questions.
Oh my God. That is so genius. You know what I mean? I am so glad you said that.
So genius.
Because I was, right as you were saying that, I was just getting an anxiety attack, imagining what it would be like to be backstage at Madison Square Gardens, about to step out for the first time on stage.
Yeah.
Oh God, yeah. I don't know if I could survive the green room situation there. I think
all the people coming in, security,
the sounds of the large crowd out there. You know,
Jay-Z and Beyonce just wanting to say hello before the show.
You're annoyed with Beyonce because you're trying to get your. That's so weird to think there's people who are annoyed with Beyonce. That's so weird. Yeah, I don't know, man. Like I that's what I love about what your book is putting out there, is just that you're fine just where you're at. Like,
yeah,
you might not be like a Kevin Hart style person, but here's something I meant to ask you up front and I forgot. Are you getting any, saying that things are okay, that you're okay the way you are, and that you're okay, that this is fine, it's actually a political statement these days. If you put out there that I'm doing great, I feel great, though a lot of times people are going to respond with, yeah, of course you're doing great. You're white. You're a comic. Uh-huh. You're doing great because you are doing great. You are actually doing great because literally you have a career. But I'm not doing fucking great. I'm like, we're all fucked. I love that you had the guts to say, this is all of it is fine. But has anyone come at you? That's crazy. I've been attacked for saying I feel good, or that I enjoy my life, or that this is great. People are like, well, that's your privilege talking. What do you think of
that? I think that that's being aware and thoughtful and grateful. And I think like all these people that you try and study and learn from, they were all different colors, all different genders, all different races. Just this isn't about the parameters and the social rules and things of the culture and all of this noise. This isn't about being great because I got a house somewhere and had this much money or that. We're talking about something deeper. You're talking about looking in the eyes of your child and appreciating that you're having this meal together. That's you doing great. And that is available to everybody, every moment.
Mm. Not when you're on fire.
When they put it out, can't burn forever.
That's what I never want to hear. I never want to hear someone say, you can't burn forever, kids.
Roll around a little.
Tom, I'm so lucky you decided to do my podcast. I really appreciate it. This is so cheesy.
Please.
Man. But I got to tell you, when I saw you were on B-Movie, I wanted to ask you something. Do you have a second for one more question?
Yeah, okay. I got nowhere to go.
Okay, great. I wasn't sure. Okay, so how many times have you seen B-Movie?
Well, I wrote on it too, so a
bunch. You wrote on B-Movie?
Yeah.
I got this. Okay, so my wife prohibited me from showing TV to Forrest because apparently you're not supposed to show TV to young kids. And so she, I don't remember where she was, but I'm sitting on the couch and I'm like, I'm going to just show him. I got to show him a cartoon. See how he reacts.
Yeah.
So, cause he hadn't seen it. So I put B-Movie on just cause that was what popped up.
Uh-huh.
Oh, he was transfixed.
Of course.
And let me tell you, I have paid dearly for that because now I have seen B movie 50 times, 30. I don't know. It's always on. He'll, you know, he'll just be like, B. Or we'll be like, you want to see B movie? Yeah. Because they don't get tired of it. Okay. So I got to ask you, you wrote on B movie. That's crazy. Is B movie a critique of socialism? Also, it's important to know it's a courtroom drama. That's what I realized. Like, this is a courtroom drama that appears to be a critique of socialism. What do you think?
No, I would say no. Just because it comes from the mind of Jerry Seinfeld, who I know for a fact does not care about socialism. He doesn't care about capitalism. He doesn't care about social movements. He doesn't care about things being meaningful or driven. He only cares about, is this funny?
Wow.
It's purely where he lives and what he conjures up. I think the audiences can draw metaphors and stuff, you know, and maybe subconsciously some of it trickled in. But I know that consciously, at least, it had nothing to do with anything other than how funny is it that that this bee is functioning in the human world, and that was it.
That's so good to hear. See, this is great. This is, you know, I love conspiracy theories. I hang out on Reddit conspiracy. Highly advise it for anyone listening and for you. But I do it as a form of, you know, I view it as kind of like modern folk stories. I don't think it's real.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they are. Really, it's the most, I don't know what happened because the conspiracy community goes through phases. So it's the most bizarre fucking thing because people will write these essays on some crazy theory. And in the essay, they will just all of a sudden be like in the B movie when as though it were real or as though, you know what I mean? Like they don't differentiate. they don't,
right.
but and I haven't seen any conspiracy on B movie, but other movies, you know, essentially there's this idea of something called, I think it's called predictive programming. And so it's a whole genre of conspiracy theory, which is that movies come out and they, you know, foretell what's about to come. They get people ready for what's coming. The Simpsons predicting this and that,
right.
Or like big movies about disasters will come out and then there's a disaster. And so people feel the Illuminati are making these movies to condition people to get ready. And so as I get, you know what it is? It's just being stoned and watching B movie for like the 28th time.
You need something else to think
and
about.
And I start thinking like, wait a minute, the bees have unionized. And because they, or also there's this sinister thing that one of the lines in the B movie, and again, this is just from having watched this fucking movie too many times, and I'm sorry to do this to you, but literally one of the lines, one of the bees is like, yeah, you work until you die. That's what you do. And I'm like, oh my God, that's hypnotic. They're trying to get people to just like not question like their identity as workers. And it's so funny to hear you be like, no, Jerry Seinfeld just wanted to be funny.
I guarantee you in the writer's room, somebody said, put that line out. Yeah, you work until you die. That's what you do. And then Jerry fell out laughing and it got in the movie.
So how many people are in the writer's room for B movie?
It was kind of rotating. It was it was small. It was like five. And then we had, here's something that I'll give you for your conspiracies.
Yeah.
The one night we were at DreamWorks working on it and we showed it to Sacha Baron Cohen and Gary Shandling. And they came into the room with us afterwards just to kind of get their opinions and any notes or whatever. And, you know, two genius minds there, right?
Yeah.
Sacha Baron Cohen and Gary Shandling. And it turned into such a bizarre, you couldn't even wrangle all the thoughts because it was, and Shandling was really going off the rails. And it was like, none of this is going to be usable. But what a moment. What a cool hour to have, like, in the writer's room. But I do remember Shandling saying something about, you know, the beehive with the guy with the smoker, you know, like, and they're all, like, all the bees are kept in the, in those, what's it called? Like a
I don't know.
Like a man-made hive or whatever that thing is.
Yeah.
And and then the guy comes in with the smoker, and he was equating that to Nazi Germany. that all of the bees were stuck in these things and they had no idea, then they just had to work and they were stuck in this thing, and it was like, what are you talking? I remember literally everybody going, what? Wait, what?
I love it. It's true though. Listen, watch it again. But from the perspective of the B movie is a critique of socialism and an invitation for people to just succumb to the machine. And you will see it in there. It's accidentally in there.
Yeah, but isn't that just what bees are? Isn't that just how bees work? Whoa. And then just because we are adapting it, putting it in a cartoon and digesting it as a human being, doesn't change that. Yeah, bees. All right, I'll go with you. Bees are communists.
They are. Bees are communists for sure. They're the Borg. They're like communists. They really don't care about their identity at all.
It's all the collective. Yeah, I mean, that is kind of like what the main bee is doing, right? He's breaking out of that. He's going the opposite way in the. In the prison, right? He's walking in the opposite direction. Yeah, but hey, don't let me burst your bubble.
You did. I'm glad. I love every time my bubble gets burst. I'm so I like because my mind just everything is a it will immediately go to the most ridiculous thing. I just think it's important for people to hear that too, because a lot of people really do. When you don't have all the information, it's very easy to project onto the world complete insanity. I mean, look at what's happening with QAnon right now. Like, that's the most wild emergent religion I've ever seen.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the thing about the moment that we're in, is that you have this way to communicate it with each other. You know, and like during Hitler, they said that was such a rise because it was also the rise of radio, and nobody was able to communicate in that way to people, and it became like the technology was grabbed by this movement and was so effective. And we're kind of in that similar moment now, where social media is this new way of people digesting all of this and thinking that it's all real, and it's able to manipulate that technology and use the propaganda for whatever reason you have. So when things catch fire, like this, like the Q thing, it's like it is catching fire. But it's really almost the way that information is being dispersed more than even the validity of the information that it's carrying.
Do you, you know what you should do if you want to do a cool experiment? Just tweet anything moderately pro Biden, anything. Just tweet like, Biden, I'm going to vote for Biden.
And then, I'm with Joe.
Tweet that and then watch what happens. It's the damnedest thing, because all of a sudden,
really,
bots will come into your timeline and they're really, I heard this on NPR. I was like, whoa. Uh-huh. But so just using a keyword, a bot will appear in your timeline and will say something that vaguely looks like it could fit in. I got one after the debates last night.
Yeah.
And somebody just wrote, I don't know why people are saying such bad things about Trump. He's really done a lot of great things, like, and list some things he did. And you look at it and you're like, wait a minute. Click on the click on that profile. Uh-huh. And you scroll down and all it is retweets of Trump shit. There's no person there. It's like, so it's bots that have been trained to swarm threads and inject their like whatever their particular message is. And but there's some intelligence to it too, because there's like, I don't know, there's like a weird, it seems like they're kind of punk rock. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. They're statist bootlickers, but they have like sort of disguised themselves as these like anarchist chaos magicians, these brilliant minds who've seen the truth. But it's like, you just like the fucking president. There's nothing more vanilla and square and embarrassing.
Right, exactly.
There's nothing interesting about it. You're just somebody who likes the president.
Like an old 75-year-old guy.
Yeah.
It's so weird. No, I'm going to try that. That's amazing. And like you said, there's not even a human being behind it. So it's like, holy cow. I mean, I remember like you know, people thinking there was messages in Pink Floyd's The Animals and like all this different stuff. But it was just so small because it could only catch fire in my dorm room. You know what I mean? Like us five guys might talk about it. Maybe the girl from upstairs will be into it. But now you just go into the net and it's like globally there's people that believe in that and start adding to it. And, you know, it's a world of make-believe.
Yeah, it is like, I think people are going to look, you know, they used to put fucking radium in watches, you know, that used to be a thing.
Right.
They're going to look back on this and be like, holy shit, that was when the entire planet got contaminated by this psychic malady that was being like woven together by fucking bots. Like, that's what's weird. Like in the old days, you go to the town hall meeting, people like, you know, stand up and yell at the mayor.
Yeah.
But imagine being in a town hall meeting, someone stands up and yells at the mayor and then like starts malfunctioning because it's an android.
Yeah.
That's literally what's happening, is like androids have infiltrated our town hall, which is the internet, and are like not there's who the fuck are they? Where are
and
they?
And even if it is a human being, it's so easy and small and lazy to be able to complain and send something out, send a message about canceling somebody. Like, it's so small. Like, if I were running like a giant network and you wanted me to take someone off of the air because of something that they said, I will only accept it in a handwritten form, in a letter that was written out, folded, put a stamp on the envelope, walk to the mailbox and put in. Because that, if there's a millions of those, then I'll listen to it. But just for people to pop off just as they're sitting there, you know, vaping at the same time just because everyone else is, like, there's no weight to that.
None.
It's all air. It's all ones and zeros. It's like there's nothing really behind it for real.
Well, man, this is the last point I want to make. I want to share with you my newest paranoid fantasy.
All right.
This is pretty fucked up. This is what I was thinking. It's like, what if all your friends had been digitized? Like, in other words, like, what if all your friends had been turned into AI bots? And every text you were getting from your friends, it was just an AI bot. You know, like, people are so absorbed into their phones. Like, the phone is so much their universe.
Yeah.
That you could have, like, a fake Twitter, fake Facebook, fake whatever, and you would believe it was real. Do you know what I mean?
Fake mom, fake dad, fake friend from high school.
Exactly. Like, how many of the people, if you're not regularly seeing people that you're texting with, Instagram, just that's like a complete replica of humans. It's not even real, but you're looking at it and you believe it's real. So this is like one of the creepy ideas about AI. And the future of humanity is that once it can replicate perfectly the sound of someone's voice, the way someone looks, if your contact with humanity is solely through your phone or through Zoom, it wouldn't be that hard to just hijack your entire universe and replace your whole universe with an AI that was pretending to be your friends.
I like it. I'll slow it down just a hair, just for the movie, just for the script idea.
Yeah.
That we're not there yet, but someone's developed the ability to do it. So when, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, when say your friend dies, then you have the option to keep him alive digitally in your life. So your friend in real time dies, but you're able to keep him alive. And you get text messages from him. He's still interacting, still posting things about his vacation.
Yeah.
And that slowly starts to happen with everybody. And we all, as everybody dies, and that's what's left is all of the digital versions.
Oh, fuck. And that's what we're in right now is the replica. We're just in a replica. We're the thing. We've already been digitized.
No, I don't think so, because I'm hungry.
But are you really? Are you really? Look, man, I could go on talking with you forever. I feel like I have I just am so lucky that I get to chat with you, man. It's really, really cool to get to be friends with you. And thanks for coming on the show, Tom.
Oh, I feel the same way. Whenever I'm sitting around thinking, like, what other guests should I get for my podcast? I think I should just call Duncan again.
Anytime.
You should be like every other week.
Whenever you want to talk, man. I love these conversations so much. I'm disappointed to hear that B-Movie isn't predictive programming to try to condition us. It's just Jerry Seinfeld being funny. But you know what? It's better, I guess, that way.
Yeah.
You got some shows coming up in November.
Yeah, I'm going to Omaha and Hilarities in Cleveland.
Awesome. All right, cool, man. And where you're Tom Papa on Twitter, or what's your...
Yeah, at Tom Papa's all the stuff, at Tom Papa on Instagram and Twitter, which is not as active. And the Breaking Bread with Tom Papa podcast that you've been a guest on.
Go see Tom live. It's worth the risk. And God bless you for being on the show, man. I don't know when I'll see your body, but in real life, unless you come up to the mountains, but
I will for sure.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
That was Tom Papa, everybody. A big thank you to him, and a giant thank you to all of our sponsors. And of course, thank you to you for continuing to listen to and support the DTFH. It's the only podcast that has won 2 Huffington Tramp Awards, and we're up for another one this year. Please vote on that. I love y'all so much. I'm going to see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.